Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Mitch McConnell invoking the nuclear option in the Senate today following his failure yesterday to get 60 votes to change the rules so that non-cabinet-level executive and district court nominations would only have to face 2 hours of debate rather than the 30 hours it now takes before a confirmation vote. Lena Schwarenstein, the Fair Courts campaign director at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, joins us to discuss the third time in 6 years that the Senate Republicans have used this tactic to thwart opposition by the minority by changing Senate procedures to get around the filibuster. Although nobody should be surprised by Senate Majority Leader McConnell's bare-knuckle tactics since he blocked Obama's pick for the Supreme Court and essentially stole the seat that Gorsuch now fills, it does mean that Trump, who has been appointing judges at a record pace, can now move even faster. And in case the power of federal district judges has gone unnoticed, a far-right Republican district judge in Texas alone was able to block the Affordable Care Act, which has opened the way for the Trump administration to try to have Obamacare killed by partisan majorities Trump has installed on the higher courts. Then we'll speak with Heather Hurlburt, the director of the New Models of Policy Change Project at the New America Foundation's Political Reform Program. She joins us to discuss her articles at New York Magazine, Hiding the Full Mueller Report is Another Gift of Vladimir Putin, and If NATO is Going to Survive Trump and Other Threats, It Must Adapt. And we will assess the meeting the head of NATO had with Trump yesterday and his address to Congress today, as well as make the case that the contents of the Mueller report on Russia's election meddling need to be made public so we can protect American democracy going forward. Then finally, we will look into moves by an apparently emboldened Maduro, who has stripped Venezuela's alternative leader Guaido of parliamentary immunity, and get an update from Alejandro Velasco, a professor at New York University and a historian of modern Latin America, who is the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. We'll discuss how life for the country's beleaguered citizens is becoming unbearable as they are caught in a outside game, trapped between the hawks in the Trump administration, whose only strategy is to add more pain to the punishment the Venezuelan people are enduring, and Russia and China, who are propping up Maduro in the hope of collecting on the debts they are owed. And joining us now is Lena Schwarenstein, who is the Fair Courts campaign director at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who previously served as a director of strategic engagement at the American Constitution Society, where she oversaw the organization's work on judicial nominations and why courts matter. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lena Schwarenstein.
Thank you.
So today, of course, the Senate voted on the nuclear option. 51-48, they voted against essentially having 30 hours of debate to confirm lower cabinet positions and federal district court judges. They've reduced it down to 2 hours to speed up confirmations. And two Republicans, Senators Collins and Lee, voted with the Democrats against this nuclear option change. Kamala Harris did not vote, so it would have been, I guess, 50-49, but that wouldn't have changed the outcome, right?
That's correct. It would have been 51-49. Yep.
You mean 50-49?
Yeah, because with Senator Harris not voting, I believe that would have bumped that 48 up to 49.
But the point is that yesterday McConnell tried this on a straightforward vote, and it didn't get to the 60-vote threshold. And he's made it clear. And frankly, I don't see why anybody should be surprised at the majority leader of the Senate's bare-knuckles tactics. I mean, he's the guy that denied Obama his court pick of Merrick Garland after the death of Antonin Scalia and essentially stole the seat for Neil Gorsuch. And this is what, isn't this about the fourth time third time in 6 years that he's invoked the nuclear option?
Yeah, Senator McConnell really does have his mindset on transforming the courts at pretty much all costs possible. And this most latest example of breaking the rules so that he can change the rules really does foster that more complete transformation. And really what this does in a new way is hide the records of some very controversial, biased, anti-civil rights nominees, many nominees who have, records of severe anti-LGBTQ animus. They have very hostile views towards reproductive rights, and they are folks who are opposed to voting rights and so on. And so this nearly eliminating all of that post-cloture debate time for the senators to really hash out and pay attention to those nominations is nearly eliminated by Senator McConnell's latest moves. Unfortunately, we've seen other nominees who are currently pending, but in the past, that post-cloture debate time has been critical in order to expose nominees' records. Take, for example, it was in just the final hour of the Senate debating Thomas Farr's nomination. He was a nominee to the Eastern District of North Carolina. Thomas Farr has a very extensive record of being somebody who has gone to great lengths to disenfranchise voters. But there's a lot of hidden information, so much so that initially the Senate Judiciary Committee was requested by many senators and others to hold a second hearing so that the Senate Judiciary could hear more. But then it was even in the very final hours of those post-cloture debate time that even more information was found out with a memo. And that's something that then caused Senator Scott and others to have pause. If that debate time had been reduced to the 2 hours that Mitch McConnell has now done, there was a good chance that voters in North Carolina would not have a judge in their district right now who would actually respect their voting rights, and that's problematic. But we're seeing that now with a number of troubling district court nominees who have very similar records that are hostile to anti-civil rights. So this really has been a deliberate effort to continue to not only just cut corners, but to hide records and to really continue to make sure it is shrouded from public view, the very appalling records of many of these nominees.
And President Trump is already appointing a record number of people there, so he'll be doing it even faster, right?
That's correct. Yeah, President Trump has already set a record of confirming more circuit court judges, and those circuit court judges are often the judges that have the final say on most cases that go through the federal courts. He set the record number at 37, which is 20% of circuit courts. So right now, more than one in five judges on the circuit courts have been nominated by President Trump. And that was really Mitch McConnell's initial focus, was to try to do everything he can to stack all of the circuit courts, so much so that some of them are nearly not recognizable anymore. And now what they're trying to do is really grease the way and pave the way so that district court nominees were breaking, unfortunately, more records there. And that's where, majority of the people, if they ever go to federal courts, that's where their cases are heard. Those are the fact finders. Those are the people who are really making day in and day out decisions about what kind of cases can go forward and so on. But when you have nominees such as Wendy Vitter, who's been nominated for a district court seat in Louisiana, someone who has proclaimed and promoted junk science and the belief that birth control pills cause violent death in women, it's really hard to believe that if she was confirmed to be a district court judge, that people would really feel like they would have a fair day in court and that she would be a fact finder, somebody who doesn't even believe that birth control pills are good or that they actually are even worse than that, cause violent death in affairs and so on. She's promoted a lot of really just misinformation and basic lies. And so that's really, really troubling. And I think that is exactly what Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans are trying to do, is to make sure that we don't see the full records of all these nominees, or that the senators do either, by reducing this post-cloture debate time.
And again, I'm speaking with Lena Schwarenstein, who's the Fair Courts Campaign Director at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. She previously served as the Director of Strategic Engagement at the American Constitutional Society, where she oversaw the organization's work on judicial nominations and why courts matter. So, Wendy Vitter, is she the husband of the former Republican senator from Louisiana?
Yes, and that's correct. She's married to the former senator from Louisiana.
Right, and she was famous when he was found out in a Madame's Black Book to have visited prostitutes. She then did a press conference dressed in a kind of sexy leopard skin outfit. That's how I remember her. The spurned woman.
Yes.
Right. Yep. So surely, though, the point to make here is how important district – I know you've made the point that how important district court judges are, but we have an example of it, surely, in the Texas judge who stymied the Affordable Care Act. He's close to the attorney general in Texas and the lieutenant governor, their buddies, and they did court shopping. They found the most right-wing guy they could find. He stymied the Affordable Care Act, and now his rulings are the basis of the Trump administration trying to kill Obamacare in the courts.
That's correct. And actually, while he is considered to be one of the most conservative judges, there's one that they're trying to rush through who could be confirmed even as early as next week, who would join him on that court. And that's Matthew Kaczmarek. And so he is somebody who works at the same organization or used to another nominee, a failed nominee, someone who, because the records were hidden and were eventually revealed, he wasn't able to be confirmed because his nomination had to be withdrawn because he was recorded on tape saying such appalling things as, transgender children are evidence that Satan's plan is working. But his colleague, Matthew Kaczmarek, has a very similar anti-LGBTQ animus. He is somebody who has very publicly criticized the decision in Obergefell as well as marriage equality. He is somebody who has very much denigrated and promoted misinformation about the LGBTQ community, and in particular transgender people, so much so that our partners at the National Coalition for Transgender Equality have helped spearhead a letter that was written by 300 or signed by 300 parents of transgender children. And they really don't believe that if he were to serve on the court that he would actually hear their case fairly. And that's because of this deep bias that runs through nominees such as Matthew Kaczmarek. And of course, it, you know, with Matthew Kaczmarek's record, it doesn't just stop at the LGBTQ community. He has also had demonstrated hostility towards other women's health issues. So that would be, you know, really troubling for anyone who is in that district in Texas to feel like they could be fairly heard by a judge.
So just in the last minute then, Lena, this is obviously a blow, and we already have a federal bench that's quite conservative, dominated by prosecutors. There aren't any, very, very few jurists who come out of being public defenders, et cetera. So it's already skewed. Just in the last minute, is there anything people can do apart from wring their hands and get furious?
Absolutely. I think wring your hands, be frustrated right alongside me, but make sure that your voices are heard because it really is important that people let their senators and others know how important this is to them, that, you know, this may be a temporary setback, but in the long run, we really need to be making sure our courts are filled with fair-minded judges who really do respect and recognize all of our human and civil rights. But if we give up now, we won't get there. So it really is important to be paying attention, to be making those calls, and to really be making the case of just how important these judges are so that senators don't get a free pass when they are taking really terrible votes on many of these very, very controversial and biased judges.
Well, Lena Schwarnstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Lena Schwarnstein, who is the Fair Courts Campaign Director at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who previously served as a Director of Strategic Engagement at the American Constitution Society, where she oversaw the organization's work on judicial nominations and why courts matter. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the head of NATO's address to the joint session of Congress today and how the contents of the Mueller report on Russia's election meddling need to be made public so that we can protect American democracy going forward. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Heather Hilbert, who is the director of the New Models of Policy Change Project at the New America Foundation's Political Reform Program. She was previously executive director of the National Security Network and served in the White House, State Department, and Congress. She served in the Clinton administration as special assistant and speechwriter to the president, speechwriter to four secretaries of state, Albright and Christopher, and as a member of the State Department's policy planning staff. And the latest article at New York Magazine's are Hiding the Full Mueller Report is Another Gift of Vladimir Putin, and If NATO is Going to Survive Trump and Other Threats, It Must Adapt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Heather Hilbert.
Good to be here.
Well, let's start with today's address to Congress by Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO. Previously, of course, the day before Tuesday, he met at the White House with President Trump. He was, I think, trying to make nice. But then the headlines that came out of that was that Donald Trump repeated the false claim that his father was born in Germany. And I guess that was Trump's way of making nice, right? But it certainly didn't work out. So let's talk about Stoltenberg's call to Congress today to confront a more assertive Russia. I think the fact that McConnell invited him along with, of course, Pelosi, I think can be interpreted as a sort of way to get around Trump's peculiar indifference to NATO.
It's really interesting that national security is, and specifically U.S. relations with Russia, is one of very few areas where there's really been a fully bipartisan willingness in Congress to push back on the president and to try to change or block his policy preferences. You saw this when Congress went ahead and voted sanctions on Russia that the president didn't really want to implement and in some cases has sought to roll back. And you saw it again when Pelosi invited Stoltenberg to speak on the Hill, and McConnell, as you said, happily joined in. And you've seen an array of statements from an array of voices really trying to signal that Trump is an anomaly and that there is strong bipartisan support for NATO. And certainly Stoltenberg, in both the remarks he made today and the effort he made to make things go as well as possible with Trump at the White House yesterday, has been eager to kind of prop that up as much as possible. And the thing you hear from European NATO allies again and again is we want to hang in there until Trump is gone. I'm not sure the wisdom or the possibility of that because the water keeps flowing under the bridge, but that's definitely the sort of attitude that NATO comes to this 70th anniversary celebration with.
So in terms of expanding NATO to Ukraine, which the Ukrainians want, and of course they just had an election in which the comedian is ahead and there's a runoff on April the 21st. But my sense is, and I talked to a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and head of Ukraine and Russia on the National Security Council, Stephen Pfeiffer, yesterday, I think it was, and it seems to me that Putin can't really go much further than the kind of low-intensity warfare that he's conducting against Ukraine because he doesn't want body bags coming home. And perhaps he also doesn't want to initiate a guerrilla war. I mean, militarily, he's got superiority, but I don't know how you could ever occupy Ukraine. The real achievement of Putin's annexation of Crimea and his attacks on Ukraine is to turn the Ukrainian people against Russia, which has never been the case, but there's apparently quite palpable hatred now. So let's deal with that particular thorny issue. Even if Ukraine wants to be a part of NATO, would they cross that bridge?
Well, first, you know, the real tragedy of Ukraine is that NATO has a set of standards of not just military standards, but also standards of democratic governance and sound rule of law. And the tragedy of Ukraine is that you can't imagine Ukraine getting to those standards anytime in the near future. And that matters much more for how people live in Ukraine, frankly, than it does for NATO membership. So, you know, Ukraine joining NATO is not a live issue. One of the reasons it's not a live issue is that in addition to the invasion of Crimea and the little green men use of paramilitaries and military assistance to foment a low-grade civil war in Ukraine, Moscow has not been eager to let Ukraine develop an independent and democratically functioning governing system, and has consistently meddled in its politics. And I think a way I would change the emphasis slightly of what you said is that the goal of what Moscow is doing is to divide and increase suspicions and polarization within Ukraine, so that the country is less and less governable between minorities or groups that are suspicious of everything that has anything to do with Russia, and groups that feel themselves threatened by Ukrainian nationalism, so that the country, you can increasingly point to it and say the kind of thing I just said: oh, look, Ukraine, it can't get closer to the West, it can't get closer not just to NATO but also the European Union, which is a perhaps an even larger threat to Russia from an economic point of view. And there, Moscow has been wildly successful with quite minimal effort. And whatever the outcome of this latest runoff is, it's just very hard to see Ukraine having a strongly functional and cohesive political system that can deliver democratic governance for those of its people who see themselves as anti-Moscow and those of its people who see themselves as pro-Moscow. That then guarantees Moscow that Ukraine is a weak and ineffective buffer state that gives them some further space from NATO's borders and also from the EU's borders.
And again, I'm speaking with Heather Hilbert, who is the director of the New Models of Policy Change Project at the New America Foundation's Political Reform Program. She was previously executive director of the National Security Network and served in the White House, State Department, and Congress. She served in the Clinton administration as special assistant and speechwriter to the president, speechwriter to Secretaries of State Albright and Christopher, and a member of the State Department's policy planning staff. And her latest articles at New York Magazine are hiding: The Full Mueller Report is Another Gift of Vladimir Putin, and If NATO is Going to Survive Trump and Other Threats, It Must Adapt. But of course, if you go back to the beginning of NATO, Stalin was more worried about the Marshall Plan than he was about the U.S. nuclear monopoly, which was fairly short-lived. And it seems to me that Putin's most afraid of democracy and the rule of law, because what does he offer? Kleptocracy and ruled by gangsters, which is one of the things that's been blighting Ukraine. And I think the reason why the comedian did well, because he plays a character on TV that's an everyman who suddenly becomes president and fights corruption. So that's very much the issue. Do you see it that way?
I should say that one of the sort of painful ironies of these Ukrainian elections is that it's very unclear where the financial and structural support for the comedian candidate came from. So there's some suspicion in some quarters about his motivations, who he represents, how you understand a fight against corruption led by a candidate who is supported by undisclosed sources. But then when you have the system that Ukraine has, sort of everyone is in that boat. So, you know, again, sort of the question of Ukraine as a NATO member is not a near-term proposition. The question of Ukraine as a functioning state and how Europe deals with Russia, and how Russia both, I mean, because Moscow has legitimate security concerns. History is full of invading powers sweeping east across Ukraine and Belarus and other countries which are now in NATO. So, you know, how you treat Russia as a legitimate power with legitimate concerns, but also say that does not give you the right to set the governments of your neighboring countries, nor does it make us relaxed about your use of cyber and other tools to disable the functioning democracies of countries further away from you. As we say that as Americans, we also have to be conscious that, of course, our own foreign policy has involved meddling in the internal affairs of other countries. So I think you sort of note that there's hypocrisy involved right at the beginning here, that this is part of how foreign affairs is conducted. But that doesn't mean that you say, okay, fine, so anything Moscow wants to do is okay.
Right, but you've raised a point with the lack of transparency about who's backing the comedian, the front runner in Ukraine, and you have to be aware of how clever. I mean, essentially, Russia under Putin is a Cheka state. It's a security state. The Seleviki and Putin regulate the oligarchs, who are the kind of cutouts. And you can see how clever he's been in influencing the U.S. elections to help Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. And that's the subject of the other article that I wanted to talk to you about. But just looking at Brexit, for what, $8 million investment in Aaron Banks, who was a major donor to Brexit, funneled through Aaron Banks' FSB wife, who's a FSB hooker from the Gulf, who was kicked out of the Emirates. It's an extraordinary story. So I wouldn't put it past Putin to have some fingerprints on this comedian.
And, of course, this is the way that, that the Russian information operations are most successful, because they sow doubt, right? So, it, you know, it almost doesn't, it, at some way, it matters less what was the decisive factor in the original Brexit vote. What was the decisive factor in the 2016 elections? What's the decisive factor in Ukraine's elections? But once you can get factions in a society arguing about legitimacy rather than at least arguing about fundamental problems and how to solve them, you're another step down the road toward disabling the functionality of the society.
Well, exactly. It didn't matter to Putin whether Trump or Hillary Clinton won, because he had his bets covered. Trump would be running around the country today leading rallies, lock her up, lock her up, had he lost, which everybody expected him to do. So, again, it does seem that the ability to divide is extraordinary, and I guess that's on us, right? That we
well, that's the point that I really want to draw out of this, that, right, this is a security and a foreign policy problem, but the solution is first and foremost a domestic solution, that if you follow your own laws and you practice good sort of legal hygiene, good political hygiene, if you actually take care of the rule of law and apply it to everyone and put significant effort into building civic trust in your country, these efforts don't work as well.
Well, let's turn, Heather Herbert, to your article in New York Magazine, Hiding the Full Mueller Report is Another Gift to Vladimir Putin, since we're talking about Putin. In general, it seems to me that if there's some mendacity going on, and there's more and more indications that that might well be the case, the idea that William Barr put out four pages and somehow got everybody to believe that that was the Mueller report and had the president exonerating himself. And we don't know what went on in the negotiations between Mueller and Barr that apparently went on for at least 3 weeks over whether or not to indict Trump for obstruction of justice. This has put a tremendous focus on the need to see what's actually in this report. Is it? And we know today, of course, that the House Judiciary Committee is issuing subpoenas or will be issuing subpoenas for the full report unredacted. We also know that the full report unredacted would go to the Intelligence Committee because they're the ones that deal with the redactions. That's their bread and butter. And it's no coincidence, at least to my mind, that that's why Trump's been attacking Adam Schiff and getting Devin Nunes and his acolytes to gang up on Adam Schiff. It seems to me that one of the ways to understand what Trump's up to is understand who he's attacking. That gives you a clue as to where he feels the most vulnerable.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, that the president has a very sort of emotional gut sense of something that one can also learn by sort of reading theory of autocracies, which is that the way you make space for personal power is to attack and weaken institutional power. And I think that's what the good folks in Russia who planned the interventions in the U.S. and other elections that we've seen understood as well. And I really want to stress about the Mueller report that at some level I care most about what we and what the Intelligence Committee and what the policy community can learn from the Mueller report about how the Russians did what they did and how we could erect the best policy responses for our electoral system, for our communication systems, for how we in the media talk to each other, to make it harder for anyone to do this on behalf of any candidate of any party or ideology in the future. And at some level, I care much more about that than I care about whether there's a case for impeachment in the Mueller report, say, or whether there are additional criminal proceedings that should or could come out of it. I am much more interested, and I know it's less sexy, and less dramatic and less clickbaity, but I'm much more interested in thinking about, you know, this is an incredible detailed dissection of how we were induced to attack and weaken our own institutions, and I want to think about how we as a society can strengthen those institutions back up and really think strategically about being less vulnerable.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, is there a connection between the fact that our voting system is so rickety, we have the Electoral College, which is a clearly ridiculous antique, and there's a lot of concerns about voter suppression underway, and you would think that any democracy that's been under attack, like the United States has in what you could describe as an electronic Pearl Harbor, would be concerned about its fragile voting system. So I'm puzzled as to know why nobody seems to be, at least of all Trump, concerned that what the Russians have done, they will do again. So is that a function of our broken electoral system?
Well, I think, you know, a few points. One is we have the system we have because the founders were so scared of direct democracy, right? So there is a way that that strand of thought is really core to the structure of American democracy and has been with us for a long time. I think we have to note that Russia and others have been successful in manipulating campaigns and elections in countries that have much more straightforward majoritarian systems than we do. So as fun as it is to point the finger at the flaws of our system, unfortunately just having a better system probably wouldn't be enough to protect us. And it should also be noted that efforts to suppress the vote and are as American as apple pie, unfortunately, and have been going on, you know, since the founding days of the Republic. And we, unfortunately, nobody needed Moscow to teach them how to disenfranchise people who they didn't want to vote. So again, as important as the Russian aspect of all of this is, the really big challenge is a sort of a communal challenge among groups of Americans, some of whom don't think others of whom should be able to exercise their franchise.
Well, on that note, which I think is an important reminder to clean up our own house, I thank you very much for joining us, Heather Hilbert.
You're so welcome. It's good to be with you. And we should never give Putin more credit than he deserves.
No, I'm not. I don't think he's a genius. And he's got an economy equal to that of Canada's. I recall that Obama referred to him as a regional power, and that really got under his skin. So I think he plays a weak hand very strongly, though, and maybe we play a strong hand weakly.
Yes, and we're good at weakening our own hand, which I think is the thing he understands. But thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Heather Hilbert, who's the director of the New Models of Policy Change Project at the New America Foundation's Political Reform Program. She was previously executive director of the National Security Network and served in the White House, State Department, and Congress, and served in the Clinton administration as special assistant and speechwriter to the president, speechwriter to Secretaries of State Albright and Christopher, and as a member of the State Department's policy planning staff. In the latest article that New York magazines are hiding the full Mueller report is another gift of Vladimir Putin, and if NATO is going to survive Trump and other threats, it must adapt. We're going to take a brief station break, and we look into moves by an apparently emboldened Maduro, who has stripped Venezuela's alternative leader Guaido of parliamentary immunity.
Otra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a faceta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran pasas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alejandra Velasco, who's a professor at New York University and a historian of modern Latin America, focusing on social movements, urban culture, and democratization, and is the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alejandra Velasco.
Thank you.
And is it a case now of Maduro sort of closing in on Juan Guaido? He's already arrested his chief of staff. They planted some guns and a hand grenade on this chief of staff and hauled him off the CBIN, the intelligence people did. And now Maduro has lifted the parliamentary immunity that Guaido has. He stripped him of that. So what's your sense? Because it doesn't seem like the Trump, Pence, Bolton, Abrahams, Marco Rubio et al., their strategies doesn't appear to be working, if indeed you could call it a strategy, which is to try and get the military to oust Maduro. So is Maduro emboldened, do you think, at the moment?
Oh, absolutely. I think he's emboldened in part because there's a sense that the United States, in supporting Guaido as strongly as it has also been bluffing in terms of how far it's willing to go. And not just Maduro, but other countries, of course, that support the Maduro government have called the United States on its bluff, notably Russia, but also China in interesting and kind of behind-the-scenes sort of ways. And so I think that that has done two things. It has certainly emboldened Maduro in terms of the ways in which pressure is now being exerted on Guaido and more broadly the opposition. But it's also sapped a lot of the momentum and energy that Guaido had initially been able to amass when he first announced that he would challenge Maduro by invoking this article in the Constitution and declaring that he was president. So I think those two things have certainly given Maduro much more strategic maneuvering room than he had before.
But obviously a U.S. military involvement would be the most counterproductive, counterintuitive, and horrendous thing. I think it would make the Iraq War look like a picnic if the U.S. were that stupid. And I'm not sure that even Trump and Pompeo and company are quite that stupid. But what do you understand is, if there is any support for Maduro, and my sense is from talking to people down there that there's virtually no support for him, particularly even amongst the areas that used to be the Chavista areas that were very, very strongly in support of both Chavez and Maduro. But is there any sort of polling? I mean, I take it that the last thing that the Venezuelan people want is to be rescued by Donald Trump. But on the other hand, they're sort of twisting in the wind, aren't they, that nobody's coming to their help?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things going on there, right? So on the one hand, if it's true that Maduro feels emboldened, in part because there's been a calling of the United States bluff and a sapping of the momentum and energy of the opposition, there's also simultaneously, of course, been a tremendous collapse, an exponential collapse of Venezuela's, infrastructure, its electricity grid for one, but also that has contributed to water shortages, which, of course, are added on to already significant problems in terms of food distribution and access and inflation, right? So all of these are mitigating the sense of strength, sort of organic and homegrown strength that Maduro could potentially be able to reap in calling the United States and the opposition's bluff. And as a result, as you well say, support for Maduro has plummeted. Is there polling? There has been some polling that has come out. The problem with the polling is that Venezuela's politics changed so quickly that the most reliable polling firms have a 2 to 3 week turnaround. So, whatever numbers I give you now are probably already obsolete vis-a-vis what's going on right now. But yes, we've certainly seen protests in popular sectors that were before much aligned with Chavismo. We've certainly seen significant amounts of repression on the part of the Maduro government, both by armed non-state actors, as well as special police operations units called FISE that have gone into these popular sectors and done significant amounts of repression. The challenge has always been, not just now, but has going back years, has always been to combine the significant and growing discontent because of the conditions on the ground from popular sectors with an opposition message that is explicitly not just anti-Maduro, but one that wants to get the government out, right? And so that's the major still kind of unknown answer to the big question: when is it that these two strands are going to come together? Discontent on the part of the popular sectors that are leaving their side of Maduro in droves, but are not yet taking up the side of Guaido.
And how would you characterize, Alejandro Velasco, the sort of inside game, if you will, or the outside game? As I mentioned, you got the U.S. on the outside, and certainly not the most credible crowd, at least to my mind, Trump, Pompeo, Bolton, Elliot Abrahams, and Marco Rubio et al. And, the U.S. has tried a couple of times, at least there's some sort of murky coups that have gone on in the past, particularly when Condoleezza Rice was the National Security Council head under Bush against Chavez, which sort of came out like the gang that couldn't shoot straight. And I'm not sure, as far as I can tell from Maduro's propaganda, from Telesur, etc., that's the constant drumbeat there, that the U.S. is behind the electricity crisis, for example, not mismanagement and incompetence, which appears to be the real reason. So you've got the inside game and the outside game. And, of course, the people that are propping up Maduro are the Russians and the Chinese, who have gotten considerable investments there. My understanding is because the country's broke, they expect to be paid back in oil for their – essentially, Maduro mortgaged the oil reserves to China. But you can't pump oil without electricity. So give us a sense of the inside game versus the outside game, if you will.
Yeah, no, I see that. I think the first thing to say is that, yes, China and Russia are heavily invested in Venezuela. And yes, they expect returns on their investment. On the other hand, I think that in part because of the play that the United States made earlier this year and back in the opposition, then marshaling so much additional international support behind Guaido, very quickly Russia and China came to see this not just as a matter of dollars and cents and oil, but they came to see this as a much more, that's much larger geopolitical matter of, who is actually going to be able to control various parts of the world, right? And so the idea, I think, in the part of Russia and China is that if the United States succeeds in backing the opposition and removing Maduro, then what will the repercussions be elsewhere in the globe for an emboldened United States presence in other parts, not just of the hemisphere, but in other parts of the world? So I think that they're seeing it not so much as, well, are we going to get this oil that's been promised to us and that we have basically purchased through these mortgaging, but how is it that we're going to be able to contain the United States, not just in Latin America, but in other parts of the world? That's the first thing that I would say. The second thing is, in terms of the sabotage, yes, you're absolutely right. The lack of investment in basic maintenance and infrastructure has long been known in Venezuela and has previously resulted in significant amounts of water shortages, of electricity, blackouts that have been rolling. What's different this time, of course, is the scale and the duration of these blackouts and shortages. The problem, of course, is that very lack of investment and maintenance also makes the argument about sabotage at least marginally plausible, because it doesn't you don't need a huge amount of operations to sabotage an industry that's already highly susceptible to any kind of failure. You can just do something very small, right? Like set up a fire in a transistor station because the brush around it has not been cleared out in years. And so what Maduro has been saying is that these acts of sabotage are hyper sophisticated and involve tremendous amounts of planning and coordination. At least that was the first line. And more recently, they've sort of reverted back to, well, it's not actually so sophisticated. They're very simple. But of course, in doing so, they undermine their own arguments as to whether or not it's lack of investment in infrastructure and maintenance that's been a major culprit. So, you know, how that plays on the ground is that people are seeing an emboldened United States backing the opposition that also links into a discourse about U.S. intervention in the region, but they are also saying and understanding that, you know, at the end of the day, this is far more about the government's inability to do basic things like provide for water and electricity. And whatever, you know, sabotage argument you want to make, you can't continue without electricity and certainly without water too long before people, regardless of the motivations, turn on you.
And again, I'm speaking with Alejandro Velasco, who's a professor at New York University and a historian of modern Latin America, focusing on social movements, urban culture, and democratization. And he's the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. Well, as much as Maduro is calling Trump's bluff, there's also another aspect of it. Sure, you know, obviously Putin and the Chinese don't want to see the U.S. essentially control Venezuela to their detriment, and then they won't get paid back for the mortgaging the oil. That sort of has the other side of it. Of course, is how Putin succeeded in Syria because Obama, with his red line, he backed away from that and gave Putin an opportunity, and he slipped in there. And he owns that. I don't know whether owning Syria is necessarily a big plus, and I'm not sure owning Venezuela is going to be a big plus for anybody, given how much investment is needed. So that seems to be where the outside players are, and I don't see any way to end the misery for the people. That's where my focus is, and that's where the focus of I think everybody should be, is on the human suffering. And now Maduro has unleashed the colectivos, who are armed vigilantes, to intimidate anybody that might demonstrate. So it seems to be that's whatever way you can see the future, and I don't think anybody can see too far into the future, but I don't see anybody rescuing the Venezuelan people, and it seems that the country is heading towards a sort of civil war.
I don't know. I don't know if that's exactly the way that I would categorize it. Certainly, I guess I see the prospects of civil war as even now much more remote than a situation like Syria or to some extent like Libya. And in part that has to do with the relative configuration of power domestically and who has weapons and who doesn't have weapons. You talk about, as you mentioned, you talk about, well, perhaps it would be in the cards that the United States would arm the opposition. But even if it did so, you know, the opposition does not have, you know, significant amounts of people that it would be able to marshal for that kind of move, right? So I don't think that that is quite in the cards. On the other hand, I do think, as you know, that the greater risk in terms of the continuing and deepening suffering of Venezuela is that what we see is a continuing stalemate that would, of course, you know, not only undermine any significant possibility for resolution and therefore potential for, you know, changing the dynamics that are creating the suffering, but more significantly lead to, you know, increased and greater amounts of penury. On the other hand, I would say that that there are on the margins. I think that you're absolutely right that the frontline story, the major thing that hits us is the suffering and how badly everything is going. But on the margins, there are some interesting, and I hesitate to use the word hopeful, but certainly in the context of how hopeless everything else looks, some somewhat hopeful moves that we were seeing. So for instance, last week, the International Red Cross announced that by way of back channel negotiations, they were able to get both Guaido and Maduro to agree to allow humanitarian aid into the country. That is a very hopeful sign, not just because it means that, you know, over 600,000 people are going to receive some kind of aid, immediate assistance, but it also suggests that this is a potential pathway towards some kind of negotiation that can exist and happen outside of the limelight, where, of course, polarization is most rewarded and no kind of negotiation is, in fact, allowed, right? So this mechanism that the International Red Cross was able to broker could provide some kind of indication that the parts are, at least on the margins, willing to see that what they assumed were their positions of strength are in fact not as strong as they assumed, right? This is also happening with the International Contract Group, which has been following a similar kind of procedure in terms of getting, talking to both parts, to both sides along the margins rather than through sort of a war of microphones. And to the extent that that continues, what history has shown is that, those are where conflict resolution accords come from, not through negotiation by way of microphones, but what happens behind the scenes. So I'm less fearful of a civil war scenario than I am of a continuing and deepening stalemate. But I am also somewhat and skeptically hopeful that there are moves on the margins to at least get parties talking about a potential resolution that would involve certainly elections, but at the very least some kind of power sharing agreement that would be difficult, but not impossible.
But on another level, there's a sort of bankruptcy, and that is in terms of the way that the debate is happening in this country about the fate of Venezuela. And you've got Marco Rubio, apparently, who's really running the show more than anybody in terms of influencing the White House. And he comes out of that sort of reactionary anti-Castro Cuban obsession down in Miami. So I don't quite know what his end game is. But then you've got also people on the American left who I'm under attack by the couple of members of the local station board here at KPFK are trying to get me taken off the air because they don't like my coverage by simply talking to people like you and Virginia Lopez, who has an article in the New York Times about how conditions are deteriorating in Venezuela for the average people. They're basically, they've released my private email, so now my inbox on my private email is being clogged up with hate mail, and basically they're saying, if you interview Noam Chomsky and Oliver Stone and John Pilger, etc., maybe you can save your job. But it's kind of despicable, and I know it doesn't necessarily reflect the American left writ large, but it seems like the debate itself, if our choices are between Marco Rubio and Oliver Stone, I think we're in pretty sad shape.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that that's been happening. I should also say that, and sometimes I sort of in dark humor jest about this when I give talks about Venezuela, that my very first talk on Venezuela was in the year 2001 when I was a graduate student. And it was titled Venezuela in Crisis. And so, I feel like my entire career over the last almost 20 years has been a variation on a theme. And the larger theme is, I think, as you're pointing out, that Venezuela has long been seen through the lens primarily of hysteria. And that hysterical sort of initial reaction, certainly in the earlier years of the Chavez era, were squarely on the side of the opposition in terms of saying things that were patently untrue about the government. That then, of course, created a sense of kind of circling the wagons behind Chavez and Chavismo in general, which then was solidified when, in the context of a commodities boom after 2003 and the Iraq War, Chavez was able to parlay some of those revenues into social programs, which made him very popular. But I think that there are vestiges of that sort of siege mentality on the one hand, and that sense of, this is an opposition that at least in its early years was anti-democratic, did not have the interests of the of the larger population in mind. But of course, that does not and should not be cause to deny the reality on the ground, which is that people are suffering mightily. And what I have seen in terms of left arguments are basically two types. One is there is no crisis, things are okay, and it's basically just been overblown. And that is just a patently false argument that can easily be disproven by looking even at, you know, left-wing sources in Venezuela, you know, organizations like Aporrea.org, or, you know, even if you read, you know, English language press like Venezuela Analysis, they will not deny the fact that there's a crisis, which leads to the other way in which the left usually speaks of Venezuela, which is, well, there is a crisis, but it's all the result of U.S. intervention or U.S. sanctions. And the problem with that argument is that, you know, it doesn't actually, there's a huge effect that sanctions have played and are playing, but it also, of course, completely exonerates the Maduro government in particular for a significant amount of mismanagement and corruption that even, again, sort of social movements of leftist actors on the ground have long been calling out, right? And so you're absolutely right that the larger kind of universe, to use, you know, maybe Chomsky's words, you know, discursive universe within which, you know, narrative universe within which Venezuela has long played out, is having to take a side, one or the other, and being attacked for not hewing one or the other side. On the other hand, I do think that there are ways to mitigate that. And I recently wrote an op-ed in the Progressive magazine in These Times precisely on this issue, how should leftists respond to Maduro? And drawing from what I speak with and hear from, you know, activists on the ground who are, you know, left-wing activists, progressive activists, people who have long been, you know, siding with Chavismo, but also have been critical of some of Chavismo's policies. And they immediately say that the first thing that has to be done is reject any form of U.S. intervention, to reject the legitimacy of Maduro, three, make sure that there is in fact humanitarian aid that comes in because the crisis is real, four, push for free and fair elections that allow for a socialist leftist alternative to be in there rather than what initially was the claim of Guaido and Marco Rubio and others, which is that this is a battle against socialism. But of course, that completely alienates those left sectors that have been battling both Chavismo and the opposition for years. And then finally, the thing to do is to make sure that we, you know, as leftists in Latin in the United States, don't cede the argument that what we are seeing now is the product of 20 years of failure, but rather to understand that you know, Chavismo has had ups and downs, swings and you know, highs and peaks and troughs, and that the same kind of sophistication that we are demanding of opposition voices in the U.S. and attending to what's going on in Venezuela should also be the way that we address the last 20 years in the country, right? So there are actually concrete ways to navigate that line that are not just playing to, you know, both sideism, but that are concretely tied to the experience of Venezuelans on the ground.
Well, Alejandro Velasco, I appreciate you very much giving that clear, I think, and reasonable perspective on what's really happening, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Alejandro Velasco, who's a professor at New York University and a historian of modern Latin America, focusing on social movements, urban culture, and democratization, and he's the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by half.